The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine comes from the archives again, since we have no new edition this week. It is dated November 7/November 14, 2022. Time is in large, bold, black block letters, superimposed upon gradations of light to darker gray, top to bottom. As usual, the outside border of the front page is in bright red with a marginal white inner border. The feature on the cover for this edition is an orange globe with hot pink continents. And in the center of, well, the center of the globe, but on the northwestern edge of South America, is a green heart. And after staring at the heart on the next page, it became white. But anyway, the planet we made is the imprint indicating the theme of this edition. Beginning then with Climate Special Report by Time. No nation can escape the impacts of climate change, and wealthy countries will have to give their vulnerable neighbors more than just sympathy. Mutually, it's assured survival. And I'm looking for an author of this, and I'm not seeing one. There's a weather vane. It's somewhat stylized art, north, south, east, west. It's in blues, golds, and white. It's an artist's rendering, and that illustration is by Greg Mabley for Time. Turning the page, The Selfish Case for Climate Justice. Aha, here's the author. Appealing to rich countries' self-interest may be the best way to their wallets, by Justin Warland. The year is 2040. Countries have blown past global targets to limit temperature rise, and the world is paying the price. The migrant flow north from Central America and the Caribbean has become a flood, but government cooperation on national security has waned. In the worst-hit nations, some leaders are considering the last resort method of trying to lower temperatures on the ground by spraying sulfur aerosols into the stratosphere, a bit of geoengineering that no one heretofore has dared to risk. This is not a grim vision of science fiction writers, but rather drawn from the assessment laid out in a U.S. National Intelligence estimate last year. Government analysts warn of 15 climate-related threats to U.S. interests that originate abroad but have a medium or high likelihood of threatening the country by 2040. That's 2040. 7 of those threats stem directly from countries in the global south, lacking the resources, capacity, and support to manage the realities of climate change. When instability happens in a country, it does not usually remain contained within that single country, says Maria Langenriekhoff, Director of Strategic Futures Group at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The U.S. intelligence community is in the business of gathering information and analyzing how it may shape the future, not offering policy recommendations. But it does not require a huge stretch of the imagination to understand the interplay between these scenarios and government decision-making. Wealthy countries can embrace an agenda that helps the most vulnerable parts of the world address catastrophic flooding, deadly famines, unchecked migration, and in doing so help prevent destabilizing ripple effects. Or wealthy countries can dismiss the concerns of their developing counterparts and hunker down to await the inevitable shock waves. If you're not going to address climate change equitably, then you will have conflict, says Sherry Raymond, Pakistan's climate minister. Multilateral systems will start breaking down. For years, decades even, providing assistance to the Global South has been framed as the climate justice agenda. The justice framing was straightforward. Wealthy countries have spent more than a century emitting carbon dioxide unchecked, and they owe it to the rest of the world to pay for the damage they've caused. Words like justice, equity, responsibility sat at the center of the plea. The logic is understandable and the moral case is compelling, even poignant, even. But after some 30 years of the climate justice argument delivering mixed results, a new framing is slowly gaining traction, an appeal to self-interest. European Commission Executive Vice President Frans Timmermans, who oversees climate policy in the EU, says the moral argument can lack persuasive power for some audiences, even if there's some truth in that argument. You have had 200 years of fossil fuels. That's what's created the problem. I could take that argument to my constituents, but I don't think it would convince them, he says. What does convince them is that if we do not increase our efforts in this area, there will be even more disruption, there will be more migration, there will be less opportunity for investment and economic development. The challenge now is to make that understanding sink in, not just among the politicians and policy makers who consult with experts, but among the citizens who put them in power. The annual UN Climate Conference, known this year as COP27, and held in November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, offered an opportunity to embrace the reality that when it comes to climate, helping poorer countries helps everybody. At the moment, there's a lot of discussion about the moral objective that anyone can forget once the meeting is closed, says Lawrence Tubiana, president of the European Climate Foundation and a key framer of the Paris Agreement. This could really be a problem of macroeconomic and global stability. The discussion should move in that direction. There's a photograph here. It's half of a two-page spread, so it's on the top halves of two pages side by side. It's all gray. It's almost black at the bottom. Then there's a striking fence. And then there's more gray, but it lightens into what might be a dark, cloudy sky. The horizon is mushy. It's water. It's the border wall between the U.S. and Mexico at the Pacific Ocean. The wall is planted in the ocean. Returning to the text, for the past three decades, the moral case for aggressive climate action has been front and center in international climate talks, and with good reason. A century of industrial development and high carbon living in the global north has directly caused problems of cataclysmic proportions in the global south. In any typical conception of fairness, the parties most responsible for causing the problem should be responsible for cleaning it up. Developed countries, most prominently the U.S. and European nations, are responsible for 79% of the global historic emissions, despite being home to just a fraction of the global population. And yet the effects of climate change are, at least for now, being felt disproportionately in places that did little to cause the problem. Flooding now regularly puts 25% of Bangladesh underwater. Countries on the African continent have emitted less than 3% of global emissions, but are experiencing the brunt of the impacts in the form of drought, flooding, and coastal degradation. Drought-driven famine in East Africa is killing a person every 36 seconds. The continent already loses up to 15% of its annual GDP per capita because of climate effects. That figure could double in the coming decades. Many prominent climate advocates have highlighted this sheer and in some ways outrageous injustice. From leaders of small island nations to Greta Thunberg to Pope Francis, and international climate agreements have reflected climate justice over and over again, emphasizing the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, a wonky way of saying wealthy countries owe it to the rest of the world to move aggressively. But they have not followed through. The policies countries have enacted to cut emissions would limit global warming to around 2.7 centigrade, according to Climate Action Tracker. That's far greater than the well below 2 degrees centigrade that countries agreed to in the Paris Agreement. At the current expected level, we will likely see the inundation of small island states and tens of millions of climate migrants in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Developed countries also failed to live up to their commitment to help their poorer counterparts adapt. The year 2020 passed without countries in the global north meeting their long-time promise to provide $100 billion in climate finance annually, beginning that year, half of which was supposed to finance adaptation. About $80 billion flowed from north to south in 2020, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Some assessments suggest countries in the global north will make up for that deficit in the coming years, but that number's now outdated. Trillions will be needed because of the effects we have now baked in with decades of inaction. These failures have put finance for what's known as loss and damage, essentially funds to address the unavoidable harm from climate change, at the center of international discussions. The climate costs to physical infrastructure, industry, and economic output will be enormous, potentially adding up to $1 trillion annually by 2040, according to a 2019 study. The risk of having to pay up is precisely what has historically kept the U.S. and European countries from a full-throated embrace of policies to address loss and damage. But there are risks in sidestepping the issue, too. It is impossible to know exactly how the effects of climate change will unfold and how these damages will ripple across the globe, but the vast body of research, government analysis, and academic literature on future scenarios suggests some common expectations. Chief among them is migration. Already, drought has uprooted communities in Central America, driving migrants to cities and eventually to the U.S. Meanwhile, drought in Syria has contributed to the struggles, driving 1 million immigrants from the war-torn country to Europe. These movements of people have, respectively, stoked political upheaval in the U.S. and helped topple governments in Europe. And it is just a taste of the expected hundreds of millions of migrants expected in the coming decades. There's also the economic damage that may begin in the global south but is likely to spill over. A 2018 study from Cambridge University, for example, found extreme weather events may begin in one country but create economic waves elsewhere, affecting everything from household income to bond yields thousands of miles away. Global supply chains will struggle to rearrange themselves in a constantly evolving constellation of climate risks harming consumers and businesses in the north. Pausing for a moment here, I found the name of the illustrator, or rather photographer, of the border wall in the ocean. That was Niccolo Filippo Rosso. And now another photo on this page. It's in color. It's really quite beautiful. The sky is blue in the background, not a cloud to be seen, and a contrasting blue in the foreground, with along the horizon little bumps and waves. I think it's topography of land. There are telephone poles or electric poles out in the middle of this body of water that's blue. And in the center, the body of water turns tan. It looks like there's a roadway beneath it. There are canoes on one side of this supposed roadway. There are motorbikes and what looks like a small motorized cart on what is supposedly the roadway. And here's the caption: flood victims relocate in Pakistan's Sawand Sindh province in September 2022. Returning to the text, all of these challenges and many more create a threat to the geopolitical order that the U.S. has ceded, fostered, and administered for most of the past century. The U.S. and Europe will have less credibility as countries grapple with the damage caused by a century of unchecked emissions. Countries crippled by internal conflict may see governance break down, allowing extremist factions to rise in the vacuum and creating space for terrorist cells. As the climate situation gets more extreme, some may experiment with untested technologies to try to shape weather patterns in their favor. A few billion dollars, for example, can buy a country the technology to spray sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere to reduce temperatures in a target region. That may be cheap in the scheme of a country's budget, but these technologies, known broadly as geoengineering, have unknown implications for the global climate. It may be too late to avoid some of these consequences, but there is still an opportunity to reduce their impact. Funding adaptation measures, think of education for rural farmers or upgraded municipal infrastructure, will help reduce the impact of a disaster and the chance that its effect will ripple across the globe. When disaster does hit, paying to help communities rebuild will help limit spillover and keep the global economy humming. The most important thing may simply be engaging earnestly to build confidence that the global north can still be trusted and that all countries can work together on climate and other issues. If the UN climate conference can begin to foster a sense of mutual faith, it will have succeeded by many accounts. For anyone with a sense of humanity, it can be downright depressing that it takes hearing about the threats to their own self-interest to make leaders in wealthy countries pay up to save lives in the global south. Some may recoil at the focus on secondary efforts in the global north rather than the immediate effects on the ground, and yet there's a simple logic to it. It works. Dallas Conyers, international liaison at the U.S. branch of the activist group Climate Action Network, says officials in the global north need to be spoken to in terms they care about. Because of the history of our government, there's very specific language that we have to use, she says. We need to start talking to them about money. None of this is going to be easy. Last year, I spoke with John Kerry, former U.S. Secretary of State and current climate envoy, on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly in New York City. Climate watchers were waiting in anticipation to see whether President Joe Biden would commit the U.S. government to upping its financial commitment to aid developing countries' climate efforts. Kerry described such a commitment as the ticket of admission for the U.S. to remain credible and said he was optimistic it would come through. But he also said it was politically challenging for the administration as it sought to pass infrastructure legislation and manage other concerns in Washington. It is just that it comes at a tricky time, he told me. The bandwidth can only take so much. The next day, Biden committed the U.S. to contributing more than $11 billion annually to climate initiatives for developing countries. Climate advocates from the Global South dismissed it as the bare minimum. A few months later, at the U.N. Climate Conference in Glasgow, delegates from the Global South demanded recognition of loss and damage and took negotiations into overtime until the U.S., the EU, and other reluctant parties agreed to a dialogue on the topic, a small step forward with only a few details agreed at the outset. But since then, a surprising momentum has emerged. With the support of partner countries in the G7, Germany proposed an insurance scheme to help protect the most vulnerable countries from the costs of climate disasters. Kerry has publicly committed the U.S. to advancing policy on loss and damage and said the U.S. will double down on climate funding initiatives in the Global South. We have to find a way for more capital to flow into developing countries, he told me, October 26, and leaders from both developing and developed nations have supported a wholesale reform of the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, with climate change in mind. The World Bank could commit to taking the first loss on big climate projects, for example, and in doing so make such projects more attractive for private sector investors. The IMF could allocate hundreds of billions in finance to give developing countries the space to pursue climate projects. These moves could in turn catalyze trillions in investment from the private sector. A conversation about the on-the-ground devastation in the most vulnerable parts of the world needs to continue, but the reality is that we also need to be talking about the ripples. Pakistan offers a prime example of the selfish case for the global north. It's a nuclear-armed state that collaborates with the U.S. to address terrorism in South Asia. It exports billions in textile and food products around the world, including to the U.S., its largest trading partner, and Europe. Sending aid to Pakistan will help it cope with its precarious climate. Glaciers in its mountaintops are melting, contributing to flooding. Meanwhile, the country's home to some of the hottest spots in the world, where heat waves already kill residents on a regular basis. Pakistan now estimates recent flooding will cost it $40 billion. As of late October, it had received $129 million in aid. But helping tackle Pakistan's issues will help everyone else, too. The entire bargain in climate negotiations now is premised on climate justice, says Raymond, and that bargain between the North and the South has to be working now. Again, this lengthy article was written by Justin Warland, with reporting by Simone Shaw in New York, and that was just slightly abridged. From the brief world, Somalia faces its worst drought ever, as the world looks away, by Belinda Luscombe. There's a fairly large, probably about quarter size page photo here. It's in color. Beautiful blue sky in the background. A real crowd, a huddle of people, and they appear all to be women. They're dark-skinned. They're wearing very colorful shawls over their heads and shoulders, green, tan, various colors of blue, orange, pink, and some black. After a series of particularly devastating famines in East and West Africa in the early 1980s, the ones that sparked the Live Aid concert and set Bono on his path from rock star to humanitarian dynamo, the U.S. set up an early warning system for when a region's food supply was going to fail. The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FEWS-NET, as it's known, monitors weather patterns, agricultural production, conflict, and aid budgets to give wealthier nations and relief agencies timely information about likely crises. With enough awareness, the thinking was, there would be time to head off the worst ravages. For months, that system has been sounding a major alarm about the situation in the Horn of Africa, which after four meager rainy seasons over 2 years is enduring its worst drought in recorded history. Many aid agencies believe a declaration of famine is imminent. Such declarations are made only under extreme conditions, when a third of a region's children are severely malnourished, a fifth of the population has no access to food, and there are 2 hunger-related deaths per 10,000 people each day. The only 2 official famines ever declared using this system were in South Sudan in 2017 and Somalia in July 2011. October 18, UNICEF warned the current situation in Somalia looks even more dire than 2011, especially for children. Allow me now to read the caption of the colorful photograph featuring all the women. Somalians line up for water at a camp near Dalo for those who have fled drought-stricken farms. Despite the precision and volume of the data, however, many people are unaware of the situation. A recent poll of Americans ages 19 to 34, conducted by the International Rescue Committee, IRC, and YouGov, that's YOUGOV, found almost 70% did not even know there was a drought in East Africa till they took the survey. This is despite the U.S. having given over $700 million in aid this year to the region, more than the rest of the world combined. This seems to be an invisible famine, says Gail Smith, CEO of One.org and former U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, administrator. It's on the horizon. It's happening. There's been plenty of warning from the Somalian authorities, from NGOs, from others. I think there's some awareness, but it's not triggered the kind of international response that one would expect. The low profile has surprised even long-time watchers of the region. It has been, you know, third or fourth page news, says Daniel Maxwell, the Henry J. Lehr Professor in Food Security at Tufts University and a member of the Famine Review Committee for Somalia. While there were big awareness campaigns for Darfur and Sudan in prior years, he says he does not see efforts for the region gaining the same traction. I don't know what it is that captures the imagination of the public. Obviously, the war in Ukraine is dominating the attention of news outlets and humanitarian agencies, especially those in Europe. But that is not the only reason this famine is getting less attention. Here's what else experts think is going on. It is a slow-moving crisis. In 2011, when famine was declared in Somalia, things escalated to a critical point, but only briefly. This time, partly because of the early warnings, the situation is grinding inexorably on. December to March are dry months in Somalia. and the 2023 rainy season is predicted to be sparse. Thousands more people will leave the land to gather in camps, which could spark disease or overtax the water supply and eventually lead to many more deaths than in prior crises. So even if famine's not declared, says Maxwell, we may not avert the kind of mass mortality we saw last time, just because of the magnitude and the likely duration of the problem. It isn't just a natural disaster. People understand and respond quickly to tsunamis and earthquakes, but famine is about more than bad weather and failed crops. A lot of the failures are social or economic. Somalia has been terrorized by militants linked to Al-Qaeda, decreasing the West's ability and appetite to offer help. South Sudan is still dealing with long-running civil unrest. Ethiopia has seen regional skirmishes, and the war in Europe has made unstable economies even less viable. Much of the food consumed in the Horn of Africa is imported. Broken supply lines do not feel as urgent as crop failures, yet they make a disastrous situation more perilous. It is probably the most severe combination of drivers of famine, but also ones that are likely to last for a longer period, says Maxwell. Prevention is better than cure, but less urgent. During the famine in Somalia in 2011, 250,000 people died, half of them children, many before the famine declaration drew the world's attention. The humanitarian sector vowed to head off such disasters, but it is difficult to direct hard-won funding to something that may happen, in the same way it's tougher to make time for a regular medical checkup than to visit the ER. Governments and international actors are still responding to the impacts of the drought instead of managing the risk ahead of the drought, read an Oxfam report in May. Some wealthy countries are struggling. The UN allocated $100 million to address the crisis in Somalia in April. In July, the head of USAID, Samantha Power, said the agency would provide $476 million. In September, she added $151 million, noting the narrow window of opportunity to stave off famine in the Horn. Later that month, President Biden announced the U.S. would contribute $2.9 billion to address the global hunger crisis, $2 billion of which was direct food aid. But other countries have not stepped up. One of our key partners has been the U.K., which has unfortunately dramatically reduced its aid budget, says Smith. So there is a deficit. It seems like the funding should cover it. The amounts of money that have been donated sound huge enough that people could believe the problem is solved, but money doesn't go as far as it used to. Food prices were at near record levels in Somalia, even before the invasion of Ukraine, says Maxwell. The aid has helped, but we're still at a worse place now than we were in February. As prices went up, people lost their livelihoods. Drought reduces the value of anything that people have to sell to buy food, either livestock or their own labor, says Maxwell. So we are at near historic lows in terms of people's purchasing power. At a recent IRC presentation, one of the Somalian field workers noted that plumpy nut, the nutritious food used by UNICEF and other aid organizations in emergency situations, had more than doubled in price from $50 per 15 kilogram to $130. And that's before the cost of transport. There are many disasters, conflicts in Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Yemen, plus floods in Pakistan and an earthquake in Haiti, are taxing the world's main providers of aid and the world's attention. We are dealing with more crises than we ever have, says Smith. and stretching the funding risks elongating the crises and failing to assist people we can actually reach. Smith would like aid budgets to be bigger, to mobilize the kind of response that is needed. You not only need to get the attention of governments, she says, you have to get the attention of the public. The attention economy is fragmented. Back when Live Aid was shown on TV globally, snagging a few key media outlets meant catching the eyes of millions of viewers with headlines the next day. This year's Global Citizen concert featuring Mariah Carey and Metallica was streamed on outlets from Amazon Music to YouTube, but seemed to make little dent in the news cycle. And it, too, had a long list of causes it needed to support. We have got a very crowded media space, says Smith, and we have got multiple issues on the international agenda. And unfortunately, this falls near the bottom. How to Be Both Ambitious and Fulfilled by Jamie Ducharme. Ambition can feel like a dirty word in the era of quiet quitting and the great resignation. Many Americans have realized that an always striving mindset can come at a cost to mental illness. Many Americans have realized that an always striving mindset can come at a cost to mental wellness. In an October report, the U.S. Surgeon General even named workplace mental health a new public health priority in the wake of the pandemic. Research has also linked chasing extrinsic goals like power to anxiety and depression. But is abandoning your ambition outright the secret to inner peace? Not necessarily. Instead, research suggests the key is harnessing your ambition for a goal that serves your well-being. We want to make sure our ambition is being directed in ways we care about, says clinical psychologist Richard Ryan, a leading motivation researcher. Striving is healthy only if we do it in ways that do not spoil the rest of our lives. Ambition is not inherently good or bad for mental health. One famous 2012 study based on data from hundreds of people who were tracked for 7 decades found that ambition strongly predicted career success, but was only weakly related to life satisfaction. Ambitious people were not drastically happier or unhappier than people who were not as driven. The target of your ambition may have a stronger impact on mental health. Studies show people who are motivated by extrinsic markers of success, such as wealth and status, are not as psychologically fulfilled as people fueled by intrinsic motivators like personal growth or knowledge. Reaching an extrinsic goal may briefly satisfy you, but it is not long-lasting, says Tim Kasser, professor emeritus of psychology at Knox College. With some practice and introspection, you can retrain your ambition to feed rather than harm your mental health. Here are 5 research-backed ways to do just that. Focus on the task, not the rewards. Research suggests you will feel more fulfilled if you focus on achievement for achievement's sake. Mastering a task, learning something, creating positive change for your clients or community, rather than striving only for the next promotion or pay raise. Some research even suggests people who follow these internal motivators end up achieving more in the end. You can have ambition and be intrinsically motivated at the same time, Ryan says. You can love your work, but it's in harmony with the rest of who you are. Prioritize your relationships. Ambition can become harmful when it crowds out other important parts of life, Ryan says. Ambition is effortful, he says. If you are going to be successful and ambitious, you have to put a lot into it. If that drive comes at the expense of psychologically fulfilling things like strong relationships or autonomy over your time, it can take a toll on mental health. Strive for growth. Instead of letting ambition rule your life, you can adopt a growth mindset, which refers to the belief that intelligence is not fixed and can be fostered. Tim Judge, co-author of the 2012 Ambition Study, and a professor at Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business, says it may be healthier to strive for growth, learning, or honing a skill, or cultivating a trait you admire in others, rather than concrete goals like getting a certain job title or salary. Do not try to monetize everything. Have you ever lost interest in a beloved hobby after turning it into a side hustle? There is a science-backed explanation. Decades ago, researchers found that attaching extrinsic motivators like money to activities that people enjoyed decreased their internal motivation to keep doing them. If psychological satisfaction is your goal, you may be better off without the extra cash. Practice gratitude. People naturally have some materialistic tendencies, especially in capitalist societies. But Kasser's research suggests suppressing those desires can yield mental health gains. Mindfulness and gratitude can help. In one study, people who meditated daily were more satisfied with their financial status and had greater well-being. Regular reflections on gratitude, relationships, or mortality have also been shown to reduce materialism, which it can, in turn, improve mental wellness. Here's an entry from Time 100 Leadership Series. The People's Conductor, this means a music conductor, preeminent conductor Gustavo Dudamel wants to take classical music off its pedestal. This is by Ed Leibowitz, and there's a photograph here by Gina Moon, and it's almost a page and a half. It's mostly black and white because it's in a darkened auditorium with an orchestra whose members are all dressed in dark clothing, are playing. Gustavo Dudamel, D-U-D-A-M-E-L, has been lured back onto the stage for his second encore. It is October 9, opening night of the Los Angeles Philharmonic's 2022-23 season. As the crowd spots the conductor, the volume inside the Walt Disney Concert Hall surges. He acknowledges the accolade, steps onto the podium, tilts his head back, lifts his arm, and hurls himself forward like a battering ram as the orchestra explodes into the first note of the Star Wars theme. There is, within this photograph, the dark photograph of the orchestra, mostly the string section, there is Dudamel kind of leaning back, his eyes closed, his curly hair on his head tilted back, the conductor's baton in his right hand, his left hand soaring into the dark space behind him. He's wearing a black suit, white shirt, and black tie, and he looks definitely serious. Well, curly, Dudamel's curly mop of brown hair has a touch of gray now, but at 41, over a decade into his time as the L.A. Phil's music and artistic director, it roils atop his head with as much vigor as when he conducted in his 20s. His patent leather shoes are a riot of activity. We don't see the shoes in this photo. When Dudamel is done, the audience leaps to its feet with the kind of reaction you would expect to see at a Taylor Swift concert. Dudamel does not take a bow. He never bows. Instead, he motions for the orchestra to stand up and share in the acclaim. He gives a big hug to Anne-Sophie Mutter, the virtuoso violinist, and tonight's featured soloist, and to another, to John Williams, as the 90-year-old composer of the scores for Star Wars, Jaws, and many other classic movies, navigates his way toward center stage. Williams and Mutter keep waving Dudamel over to join them, but he refuses to make it a trio. Instead, he stays on the sidelines, turning toward them in profile, just one more adoring face in the crowd. Music is not only an element of entertainment in society, Dudamel says, it's a power of transformation. You're sitting there for a symphony that is like 30 or 50 minutes and time is gone. It unites us, even if we come in feeling completely different. Under Dudamel's aegis for the past 13 years, the L.A. Phil has spread classical music's unifying power well past its traditional confines, across the divides of class, race, gender, and age. It is an eventuality the New York Times did not envision in June 2005 when it published an article titled "Decline in Listeners Worries Orchestras." In places, the piece, written by the Times classical music critic, reads like the prelude to an obituary. Orchestra subscription sales are dropping widely, in some cases by as much as 2 percentage points a year. Ensembles are not balancing their budgets. Audiences are getting older. Young people are turned off by classical music. What was creeping toward death's door was not classical music itself, but classical music as an elite and exclusionary art form. Within this framework, the great orchestras were dominated by towering white men of genius who safeguarded and elevated a canon dominated by towering dead white men of genius. Among them, Mozart, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky. Performances of these masterworks were geared to an audience prideful of its refined tastes and getting a bit long in the tooth. The emergence of Dudamel as perhaps our greatest living conductor is itself a disruption. Dudamel and the L.A. Phil often provide orchestral accompaniment for pop icons like Billie Eilish, who bring in hundreds of millions of teens and 20-somethings. Their Youth Orchestra Los Angeles, YOLA, has outfitted 1,500 of the city's most vulnerable children with free violas, trumpets, and other instruments, provided free lessons, put them on a stage. The high school graduation rate for YOLA musicians stands at 100%. 90% of them go on to attend college. By contrast, the Los Angeles Unified School District has a preliminary graduation rate of 85%, and about 61% of the district students attend college, according to the latest data available. And two mentees of the L.A. Phil's Dudamel Fellowship Program have gone on to break crystal chandeliered ceilings before they turn 29. In 2016, Lithuanian-born Mirgra Grazentjetaila became the first female music director in the history of the City of Birmingham Orchestra, while next fall, Jonathan Hayward will become the first black music director to lead the Baltimore Symphony. Business-wise, it is all working. During the pandemic, the Phil expanded free online access to Dudamel's concerts. The 2021-22 season opening gala, virtually streamed from Disney Hall, garnered 2.2 million views. For fiscal year 2018-19, the last before the pandemic struck, the New York Philharmonic took in $24.8 million in concert sales, whereas the L.A. Phil realized $93.9 million. 3 months after the Times article appeared, Dudamel made his U.S. debut at the Hollywood Bowl. The previous year in Bamberg, Germany, Dudamel had taken first prize in the first-ever Mahler conducting competition for young maestros. With that win at age 23, he'd become a piping hot commodity in an ailing industry. The moment he walked into his first L.A. Phil post-concert artist dinner, he realized he'd been put on the menu as the evening's main entree. Gathered around the table were the executives of 8 major American orchestras, who'd flown to L.A. to catch the concert and acquaint Dudamel with what their organizations had to offer. Dudamel politely greeted the executives one by one. Then he told them that he couldn't stay for the meal. He decided to celebrate at a local hot dog stand. He left the room and flew out of town the next day. I love this because it's so authentically Gustavo, says Chad Smith, then with the New York Philharmonic, now the L.A. Phil's CEO. At a time when any other conductor would be working everyone, what have you got for me? He was telling them, I'm not interested. This is not what I want to do. It was a really eye-opening experience that he had the wherewithal to do that and just didn't play the game. Dudamel was not born to play the game, nor was he nurtured, educated, or socially situated to play it. Classical music, as he first experienced it, was an art without hierarchy, where no one was to be excluded from the orchestra or the audience on the basis of race, ethnicity, or class. Dudamel was raised in a working-class family in Barquisimeto, Venezuela. His mother was a voice teacher, and his father played trombone in a salsa band. But perhaps more important to his musical development was El Sistema, Venezuela's nationwide classical music education and performance program for disadvantaged youth. El Sistema welcomed five-year-old Dudamel into its fold and put a violin in his hands 3 years later, for the first time for him. Founded in 1975 by the late conductor and philanthropist José Antonio Abreu, El Sistema continues to provide free instruments, one-on-one lessons, and social support to its students, as well as a sense of agency and self-worth that for many of them had been in short supply. After Dudamel traded in his bow for a conductor's baton, Abreu would become his teacher, mentor, and greatest artistic influence. Dudamel still calls him my maestro. L.A. Phil launched its YOLA program in 2007 after Dudamel took Smith, then the orchestra's director of artistic planning, and Deborah Borda, then its CEO, on a guided tour of El Sistema's good works in Venezuela. To many of the musicians of YOLA, Dudamel has become what Abreu was to him, a teacher, a cheerleader, and a resounding reminder of what is achievable. Dudamel had only been playing violin a few months when he was assigned to the back of the second violin section of an El Sistema 600-piece orchestra scheduled to perform at the anniversary celebration of his city's founding. He could coax only three notes out of his instrument and quickly decided to quit. I said to my teacher, I cannot play this, Dudamel recalls. And he says, just enjoy, live the moment, and you will see. He did. We played that first note, Dudamel said, and this feeling went across my body and my ears. The music transformed me. We were all transformed that day. As Dudamel remembers it, even after he became a teenage conducting sensation, he was not so much intent on leading a great orchestra someday as on making a living playing music with his El Sistema friends. That was the most wonderful thing, Dudamel says. We were all creating our own path as a group. That is why, as a conductor, I feel like another musician in the orchestra. I'm skipping ahead now to a bridge approximately one column of this article. The conductor recalls something his mentor, Abreu, once told him, how the destitute young musicians of El Sistema should not have to make do with what is merely adequate, how they must be provided with the best instruments, the best teachers, the most inspired spaces in which to grow and thrive. My maestro always said the culture for the poor people cannot be a poor culture, Dudamel says. That is beautiful. Give these children the resources and they will create their own future, their own dimension. Obi-Wan Kenobi could not have put it better. In the next couple of minutes, I'm going to read you just a few headlines from within the climate viewpoint section. One is A River's Day in Court. An indigenous community in Ecuador fights to save its river from the green transition fallout. What Clemente Grefa remembers most about his childhood are the sounds of the Piatua River, the hum of insects, the chatter of children playing, the women whistling as they clean clothes, and the burble of water trickling. I am a climate migrant by Niobe Morris. I was 10 when flooding displaced my family from the Buteleya district of eastern Uganda in 2008. Illegal sand mining along the river banks exacerbated flooding already made worse by climate change. We lost our farm and home, so we moved over 130 miles away to Kampala, Uganda's capital city, where we lived with my maternal grandma. But her home quickly became crowded, so we moved to a one-room rental, much smaller and less beautiful than our old home. It was too much for my father. My mother raised my siblings and me after he left. She often struggled to find enough food or money. I cannot count how many times we went to sleep hungry because we could not afford food. Back on our farm, we had plenty to eat, but we still could not escape the impacts of climate change. I'll never forget one night in November 2014. It began to rain. The power went out. Water flooded our room. We stood outside all night. The next morning, we moved back into our grandmother's house for 4 months until my mom could afford to rent a new home. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.